Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Well, good evening and welcome everyone to the sixth virtual stock slam of the year. It seems quite remarkable given that it's only October, but there we are. We've done six events, or this is the sixth anyway, so I'm really very happy with that. It is great to be back again after the last event in September. I mean, the autumn markets have been pretty choppy. They've thrown up some bargains, but they've also made looking after our portfolios quite tough. But we have an excellent lineup of speakers and companies with some familiar names slamming along with some new faces tonight. And hopefully, we're not too late to pick up a few bargains. There might be some ideas here which, you know, we can catch while maybe prices are suppressed. So fingers crossed. Before we kick off, I'd just like to thank Alan McBride for updating me with the performance of the picks from the last five slams. There's a total portfolio now of 50 holdings, and it's currently up 11.2%, which is a step back from the 15.2% reached last month. However, as I said, it's not been an easy market in the last month, and the September picks haven't really performed. And, you know, who of us is at an all-time high? So, you know, 11.2% is still pretty good. Now, once again, I'm amazed to say Tech Capital is at the top by a huge margin. I mean, the doors have well and truly been blown off here. It's up, it's hard to believe, 211% in just 6 months. It's an astounding pick, an astonishing gain. And I really hope a few of you took a look at it and decided to invest after doing your own research. You know, we're just giving ideas here. If you've done your own research and you looked at tech, well done. In second place, there's Renault, and that was 79% up, with Cakebox not far off at 58%. I mean, all three have been very solid performers for a while, which kind of backs up the idea that you should run your winners. When things are going well, they tend to keep going well. Of course, the converse is true. When things go bad, they tend to get worse. And really, at the other end of the table, we've got a trio of dogs here. We've got Micro Focus, Novasight, and Caledonian Mining. Now, I'd argue that the first two of these are kind of suffering from troubles of their own making. Yeah, Micro Focus has a huge amount of debt and has done troubles. Novasight, well, they've got well-publicised battles with the NHS and getting paid. And the jury is kind of out on whether they'll actually turn themselves around again. However, I wouldn't say that that's the case with Caledonia. Their mine expansion is going very well and the high gold price remains. So profits are high. I think it's sentiment's the problem. I think in the long run, it'll do well. So for those new to the slam, I'll just quickly explain how it works. And perhaps most of the audience aren't new, but anyway, I'll just go over it. Each presenter is given 3 minutes to pitch their idea, which goes past very quickly. And then we allow another 3 minutes for questions. Tamsin will explain how this works in a moment. After that, I will introduce the next speaker and we'll start the whole process again. All in all, this should take just around an hour or so, and then we can all relax for the rest of the evening. Now, one other thing I'd like to mention is that everyone presenting here is doing it in a personal capacity. We're not giving share tips or advice here. These are simply our investing ideas that we're happy to share with all the other investors. This means that you should assume that presenters hold the shares they're pitching. They're talking their own book. And generally speaking, I tend to speak about the shares I hold because they're the most interesting to me anyway. So there's no point waiting around. I'll kick off with the very first pitch. Tonight, Driver Group, ticker DRV, is going to get its moment in the sun. In simple terms, this is a consultancy firm. It brings together a group of professionals and contracts them out to companies involved in the construction and engineering industry. I mean, these professionals are experts in the entire construction lifecycle, from planning to project management to dispute resolution. And clients employ them because they have an issue requiring expert assistance, or they wish to avoid running into such an issue. The investment case here is that up until a few years ago, the group was poorly managed and chased top-line growth at the expense of profit margins, which always seems a poor strategy. It needed a new board to turn things around, and they were duly appointed. And since then, they've been closing out unprofitable projects, chasing long overdue bills, and shifting the group to higher margin contracts. An example of this is DRLIS, which is the group's expert witness support service. This is a specialist offering that can be the difference between winning and losing an expensive legal case. So, of course, clients have money on the line here, and they really need these experts to be at the top of their game. This process of recovery was absolutely disrupted by the pandemic, no doubt about it. This is a global business that relies on the construction industry actually constructing and completing their projects. So last year was a bit of a write-off, although the business remained profitable and net cash actually increased by 50%. And the first half of this year wasn't much better. So not only was the construction industry subdued, there was also they lost an entire team in Singapore, which hardly helped. However, in the latest update, just out last week, it seems that activity levels have materially improved in Q4, with all areas of the business returning to profit. This suggests to me that Driver Group has reached the nadir of its fortunes and that the turnaround efforts of the board are about to bear fruit. One reason for this is that a large number of construction projects fell into trouble during the pandemic, and only now are the companies involved starting to address the legal repercussions. In other words, who foots the bill? The sheer volume of cases ensures buoyant demand for the service that the driver offers. And the second reason is that the board have refocused fee earners away from the Middle East and are actively tapping into the North and South American markets. And here, there's a lot of government work available, along with insurance and oil and gas claims. So, how will this work out for investors? Either slowly or quickly, in my view. The slow route involves the shares being re-rated as sales and profits recover and operational gearing kicks in. Peer group companies have an average PE ratio of around 28, double driver's rating, so that's something to aim for. The quick route involves private equity firm AB Traction getting involved with a buyout, sale, or other realization event. They are already a 20% shareholder in the company and have a history of successful exit events with Waterman and WYG, which suggests they know how to buy stakes in professional services companies before selling to a bidder. In either case, what we have here is a prepared management team meeting the right opportunity. And that's it, before time.
Thank you very much, Damien. We do. How much reliance do they have on the oil and gas sector?
Oh, that's not a big center for them. I mean, the oil and gas stuff is really work that they can pursue in America and obviously places like Texas. But in other areas around the world, it's much more in the kind of the standard construction that goes on, you know, and all around the globe. They're not subject to the vagaries of the oil and gas market.
Thank you. And are you worried about the shrinking margin? And do you know if there are plans to address it?
Yes. I mean, that's really part of the problem, is this, that the last year and a half have not been kind to the company, despite their efforts to turn it around. But they're focusing on higher margin work, stuff like Dialis, which is good high margin work. They're exiting low margin work. And this was one of the things that the previous management tried to build up. This was project management work, and they're just getting rid of that. And also, what will happen is margins will improve as utilization improves. So they have obviously a baseline of costs, which they have to cover. Then anything above that is kind of adds to the bottom line almost directly. So that's the operational gearing effect will then help to boost margins as well.
Great, thank you. And how are they going to scale? Does it involve adding lots of people?
Yes, it's a people business, no doubt about it. I mean, they did a webinar last week, and that was certainly one of the questions that was asked, is how do you scale the business? And this isn't a business that's going to grow 10 times. It's not that sort of business. What it is a people business, and they require very expert staff in order to deliver to their clients. And so what they are doing is consistently recruiting. Conditions aren't easy to recruit, but they are recruiting. And if they do any acquisitions, they won't be really acquiring to get into different sectors. They'll be acquiring to bring in a new group of professionals who can then join the group.
Thank you. And what was the trigger for the 20% increase in the share price last week?
Well, like I said, they did an update last week, which was very positive, basically saying that the Q4 of last year has seen an upsurge in kind of client demand, and also all parts of the business turned to profit. But also the fact that I think that it's just basically underrated, and that people are realising that the turnaround itself is starting to kick off.
Thank you. And how well developed are they in the US? Is it a new venture?
Yes, US, you see, that is a big focus. And the CEO actually is personally in charge of the US expansion. And they've basically got an officer over there at the moment with a few people in it. And they are actively expanding to address both the North American market, which is obviously the US and Canada, and also to have some offshoots in South America where there's a lot of work available to them. But yes, the US is a definite focus for them.
And very quickly, what actions are they taking to keep the current staff?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that. I did ask the board actually, essentially what it was like to work at the company and what was, you know, how does the company work? And I think while they didn't directly say how do they keep staff, I think you could tell that there was a sense of enjoyment and a sense of desire to do a very good job for their clients. And I think there's if you like, it's that sense of being a true professional and delivering value to your clients. And I think it's that personal sense which obviously keeps some of the staff there, and also obviously, you know, being paid decently well. But I probably have to ask the management that direct question to truly answer that.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Damien. We've run out of time, so back to you.
Okay, well, that was super quick. Next up, I'm happy to say we have Dee O'Hare, who's going to talk about crystal amber. Over to you, Dee.
My name's Dee O'Hare, and there's five things I look for in a share. A simple story, good cash flow, limited downside, potential to rise maybe 50% in 2 or 3 years, and confirmed by a chart pattern. I'm going to talk about Crystal Amber Fund, price 115p, market value 95 million. Stock ranks, quality 45, value 95, momentum 41, overall 64, a neutral stock. So what do they do? Crystal Amber is an activist investor. They own roughly 20% stakes in 6 companies and have net cash. Of the 6 stakes, 5 are listed on the UK stock market. A recent RNS stated that the net asset value per share was 150p at the end of September. Taking yesterday's stock market values and making 2 adjustments, the current net asset value per share is 162p. So with Crystal Amber shares at 115p, that's a discount to assets of about 30% with net cash. So why do I think the discount will close? Well, every year CRS holds a continuation vote in November. It's expected this year shareholders will ask CRS to wind the company up. So if CRS can dispose of its 6 stakes at less than a 30% discount, then there's a profit to be made over 12 to 18 months. Let's have a look at the 6 companies. I think several of the companies actually have upside. So I'm deliberately only going to give you the positive angles on the companies just to whet your appetite and obviously do your own research. Remember, you're already buying them at a 30% discount to the current stock market price. First company, De La Rue. It prints 30% of global banknotes. It specializes in the latest security of banknotes. Currently, only 3% of global banknotes have this latest security system. And despite our cashless society, banknotes are currently growing in circulation. Equals is an e-banking and international payments services provider and has grown fivefold in the last 5 years. Crystal Amber believes that next year, Equals can deliver earnings per share of more than 5p, and Equals has 10 million of cash, and CRS think it's ideally positioned to be part of fintech consolidation. Sutton Harbour, it's a marina owner, which makes good profits now helped by the pandemic, and a large brownfield land developer close to Plymouth Airport. GI Dynamics helps with development sort of in obesity, minimal invasion for obesity. Allied Minds, which is the smallest weighting, is an investor in life sciences and technology companies. It has assets of 40p per share, and yet its stock market price is only 22p per share. Hurricane Energy is a small North Sea oil producer, and there's huge equity benefits from the current high oil price. And there are also huge tax losses available for trade buyer. This is one of the most interesting of the 6. Last year, CRS took the directors to court regarding a dilutive equity debt for equity swap, and the High Court won. So as I see it overall, CRS is a better than cash investment for the next 12 months. I see limited downside and possible 20 to 30% upside, even if none of the 6 companies get taken over. There's a 4% dividend yield and a revaluation catalyst due next month. The chart also indicates a steady uptrend with few sellers.
Tremendous. Thanks very much, Dee. What has the Crystal Amber discount been before? Has it ever traded close to parity to net value of the asset base?
So historically, kind of maybe it's averaged 20%. However, I think the key point here is about the fact that they're going to be winding up. So part of a logic for the discount is the fact that you're paying management fees over a long period of time. Whereas if this continuation vote succeeds as such, they're only going to have 1 or 2 years of fees, management fees to pay.
Thank you. Two people are commenting on Hurricane Energy, one saying they've got quite a mixed record and the investment in Hurricane's been disastrous, and the other one saying that Hurricane has got enough reserves to last to next year. What's the value thereafter?
Well, again, I deliberately pitch this as whet your appetite. CRS in the RNS yesterday detail exactly the figures, and it's plain as day to see. So Hurricane has not been well run, and it certainly hasn't been run for the benefit of shareholders. Just taking the production figures which Hurricane have given, taken current levels of profitability because they have a low cost of getting the oil. They have more than enough money to pay back debt and have huge surplus cash flow. Plus, as well as that, they have cash losses, which are estimated at 4p per share compared to the current share price of 5p. Plus, they have a development asset, which again is worth multiple of the current share price. So regardless of what I say, CRS detail the figures for you in the two RNSs recently.
Thank you. And why did they have negative revenue in 2020?
No idea.
Thank you. If it gets voted through, do you think they would become forced sellers and therefore the prices of the individual companies would drop?
Well, actually, that's what attracts me to it. So everyone knows this vote's going through, very likely. Everyone knows there's forced sellers. So if you look at those six companies, what would you expect to be happening? You'd expect the share prices to be going down. Four of the six companies are in a very positive chart uptrend, and the other two are flat. So that doesn't in any way indicate that people are worried about these companies coming to the market. And of course, if I was looking to buy one of these companies, I wouldn't have been looking to buy them a year ago because I would have assumed Crystal Amber isn't going to sell. Whereas now, as an acquisitor, I know that Crystal Amber are a forced seller. So bidders are definitely going to be on the table. And Crystal Amber themselves, they say because they know this vote has come about, they're already talking to people about how to liquidize their stakes. So there's no reason for them to bluff on that because the proof's going to be in the pudding over the next 12 months.
Great. Thanks very much, Dee. There are more questions, particularly around Hurricane, but we've run out of time. Thanks very much indeed.
Thanks again, everyone.
Cool. Yeah, thanks, Dee. I mean, as you say, it's an interesting way to get exposure to De La Rue and a few other companies that are a fairly steep discount. I mean, if nothing else, the commentary is worth reading for its outspoken criticism of certain management teams. They don't pull their punches. So, yeah, well worth a look. Yeah, I'm very happy to have Lewis Robertson here, his presenter tonight. He's going to be talking about SNU, which is a company I know a little bit about. So, you know, over to you, Lewis.
Very good. Good evening, everyone. SNU PLC, my largest position, is a family-run financial business with a £350 million market cap. It has a track record of decades of profit growth, a conservative culture, and a highly competent, aligned, and principled management team. They're also proven winners with long-term shareholder returns of over 15% per annum. What do they do? Well, SNU has two divisions, property bridging and a non-prime car finance business, which represents over 90% of group profits. Fund managers are snobbish about non-prime lending, but it can be exceptionally attractive. Advantage Finance, SNU's subsidiary in the space, has consistently grown lending and profitability since its foundation, including through the global financial crisis. And that's because they know how to score customers. They know which customers with poor credit are unlikely to pay, but they also know which ones can, for whom the previous issues were an isolated incident. And doing that work, trying to figure out how to price riskier loans and to whom to lend, is very lucrative, because the banks don't play here. Less competition means higher interest rates, 16 to 17% flat. This is why the group has managed a return on equity consistently between 15 and 20% for two decades, despite having a balance sheet with vastly less leverage than other lenders. No surprise, given the family own half of the shares. They don't want to blow up, and they don't care about showing growth for growth's sake. So why buy now? I see two key reasons. The first is that, as a result of COVID, the group has been very cautious with its accounting. They carry provisions equal to 27% of their receivables, the highest level since 2012. These provisions represent losses already taken through the income statement to buffer against future non-payment. But recent debt collections are at the highest level in years, and an incredibly strong used car market helps collateral values. As a result, I believe the group will have proven too conservative, and the release of these provisions will boost earnings and bolster group equity. But more importantly, I also believe there is very strong growth momentum. Advantage is opening up new sales channels, including partnerships and online comparison sites, which are already providing significant new deal flow. Management's bullish rhetoric and recent new debt facilities suggest they are gearing up to seize these opportunities. As a consequence, I believe market forecasts meaningfully underestimate where this business can go in the next few years. I hope you'll be pleasantly surprised that you can buy SNU with its shareholder-friendly management, superlative track record, and near-term growth prospects at around 11 times forward earnings. I believe they can reach over 40 million of net profit in the next few years. And I think that will support a share price of over £45 against £29 today. will also be enjoying healthy dividends along the way. SNU is illiquid, and the family don't take the city line of selling some of their company simply to generate liquidity. But if you're willing to back them for the long term, I think it's one of the best risk rewards out there as they continue the group mantra of steady, sustainable growth.
Great. Thank you very much indeed. Lots of questions coming in. Are the car dealers trying to squeeze these out with their financing arms?
Typically, it's non-prime finance, and it tends to be old cars, right? So this isn't new vehicles we're talking about. It's always used vehicles. So the extent to which dealerships get involved in direct financing, I think, is fairly limited.
And what's liquidity like?
Very slim, as I say. Look, it's a result of the family owning half of the shares, and a big foundation owns another 20%. So you can buy a stake, but you have to be fairly patient in doing so, and there's a bit of a spread. But look, that's an opportunity, I think, for long-term investors. If you're willing to bear that upfront cost, there's a reason it's cheap, and that's because fund managers in the city can't really get involved.
And do you know much about the Coombs family? Have you met them? Do you know anything about what they're like?
Yes, I've met them on many occasions, and I would encourage anyone who is interested to watch the presentations on Investor Meet Company, which are excellent with the business. They're very open with their time. They're very accessible, and I think they're genuinely interested in encouraging a shareholder base who cares about what they do and wants to know as much as possible. I think they're good people.
Thank you. And how cyclical is it?
Look, that was always my concern with the stock, I have to say. But profits grew in 2008, they grew in 2009, and they grew in 2010. And I suspect, they would have had an excellent year last year if it wasn't for the fact that the FCA sort of unilaterally mandated that customers could take 6 months off without paying their loans, which created some problems. But as it happens, customers are now back to paying as well as they ever have been, and they remain profitable, and they'll have probably their best year ever this year. So less cyclical than one might think, I would say.
And are there regulatory risks?
Yeah, look, absolutely. This is something that investors do need to get comfortable with. The way I got comfortable, by the way, was by reading all of the financial ombudsman complaints against the business. And there's a few hundred of them online. And I sort of thought to myself, I'm going to read these complaints. And if I find, 5 or 10 cases where I really think the company is taking the mickey, I'll really reassess, because that might be indicative of a rotten culture. And people don't believe me when I say this, but I honestly didn't find any where I really thought, the company is in the wrong here. There's a few where they're a little more aggressive than I might like. But I genuinely think they're trying to do the right thing by customers. And I think that puts them in good stead with the regulator.
And very quickly, the company has historically traded at a price to book between 1.2 and 1.5. And today it's closer to 2. Is the growth not priced in?
It depends how far you look back. If you look back further than that, they traded at a significantly higher price to tangible book in the past. You could say so. Look, I think the return on equity is very strong now, and stronger. It looks to be stronger than it has ever been before. So I'm quite happy to pay the price.
Great. Thank you very much. We do have more questions, but we've run out of time. So Lewis, thanks very much to you.
Thank you.
Damien, back to you.
Okay, great. Thank you, Lewis. I'm a big fan of SNU. With their sensible investor-friendly approach. I mean, in my view, they're as far removed from the poor quality leveraged approach of other lenders as it's possible to be. So I think that holds them in good stead. So next up, we have Mark Bentley, who's going to tell us all about UP Global Sourcing. Off you go, Mark.
Thanks very much, Damien. Good evening, everyone. So I'm going to talk about three things relating to UP Global Sourcing: what it does, a bit about the numbers, and why now might be a particularly good opportunity to invest. So what it does, it owns or licenses homeware brands. For example, Beldray, Salter, Russell Hobbs, it licenses for non-electrical products. It designs, produces, and sells, quotes, premium products, unquotes, for discounter prices. That's its marketing shtick. It sells via supermarkets, discounters, and online via Amazon in the UK and in the EU. Through all of those channels. It contracts its manufacturing to the Far East, mainly China, but it's diversifying its sourcing to other Far East countries like Vietnam as well. It's recently acquired the entire Salter brand, previously had a license only for products excluding scales. It operates from Oldham, has a strong graduate recruitment program, and offered support to the local community there, which was especially hard hit during COVID. reflecting a very strong management track record with this business and good ESG culture. Briefly on the numbers, as you can see from Stockopedia there, it's a super stock. We have historic earnings growth of 13.8%, but only a forward PE of 12.1 now, and paying a 4% dividend. Has very modest debt. And if you look at the ROCE numbers at the bottom right there, you can see it's got a greater than 50% ROCE, which is fantastic, due to it being a relatively capital light business. Why is there an opportunity right now? The share price has fallen from highs recently. I suspect that's due to supply chain worries. In a recent trading update, the company said, quotes, shipping availability continues to present challenges, with forward orders from the group's retail customers being prioritized ahead of stock purchases. Management expects that global shipping will remain disrupted until after the Chinese New Year in February 22. But despite that, it says current trading remains in line with expectations, with growth expected in 22, both from the core business and through the acquisition of Salter. So they seem to be coping with the supply chain issues well. Full year results are expected next week. So could be an opportunity, but as always, make sure you do your own research on this.
Tremendous. Thank you very much indeed, Mark. Yes, absolutely. Do you have any more colour on how UPGS will manage the logistics issues that are occurring in the Far East in the short term?
To be honest, no, I don't know. I mean, it's not, the logistics issues aren't just in the Far East. It's the whole supply chain. Shipping globally is disrupted. So it's a case of timing your orders correctly, which they've proved pretty good at historically. So I would imagine it's by careful planning that they're still able to meet much of their customers' demand.
Thank you. Do you know what proportion of their revenues depend on China, i.e. the product coming from China?
It's very high, certainly 80% plus. But as I say, it's a question I asked them myself, and they indicated that they were looking to diversify their sources of supply.
Great, thank you. And who are its main competitors, and what's their USP?
Well, that's quite a tricky question. I've mentioned that, I mean, the company is known, and obviously its sales and marketing is through the brands that they own. So I've mentioned Beldray, Salter, Russell Hobbs. So it's companies that are similar to those would be its competitors, or companies selling products from brands that are similar to those. But most of them are, Beldray is the largest one, which is laundry products, and small home appliances of their sales. Well, it was historically Salter, I'm sure will become number one now. So I think you really have to look at it in terms of competition and US. Well, USP is a little different. That's a slightly different question. Its USP, I think, would be its skill in developing the products and building on those brands, which it's proved very adept at historically.
And do you think they'll be able to pass on cost increases, supply cost increases to customers? And is their margin strong enough to overcome the supply issues?
Yes, it is. If you look at the Stockopedia numbers, you'll see they've got good margins. Historically, I think they've managed to maintain their margins, so I would expect that they'll be able to push prices up to cope with it, with rising costs. That remains to be seen. That, of course, is a risk. So it's a good point, but one that I would expect them to cope with based on historic performance.
Thank you. And very quickly, what's your target price?
Oh, I don't do target prices. it, of course, depends on the time frame. My strategy typically is I'm expecting to hold things for at least 5 years, something like this, possibly for longer, unless the price goes crazy. And I'd expect I've got a fair chance of doubling my money in that period.
Brilliant. Thank you very much indeed. And that's all we've got time for. Damien, back to you.
Thanks, everyone.
Cool. Thanks, Mark. I mean, I agree with you. I think the UPGS team have played a blinder with their software acquisition. I mean, it beefs up their brand portfolio, removes licensing uncertainty and boosts profits. As you say, if they can navigate their way through the supply chain issues, then the future looks pretty bright. Very nice. So next up, we have Jack Brumby, who's going to talk about RBG Holdings. Off you go, Jack.
Thanks, Damien. So this is RBG Holdings. It's a company I've encountered a few times in the small cap report, and it's identified itself as a company that's moving at pace. So for that reason, I find it quite interesting. And I did buy some shares to follow the journey here. It's an interesting one. It used to be a traditional law firm called Rosenblatt. And what's happening across a couple of these professional services companies is that there's a shift, a bit of a movement towards a more commercial mindset. And there's a lot of acquisitions and consolidation going on in the space. I think RBGP is not just a mass consolidator here. It's actually quite targeted and selective in its acquisitions. It's going after cherry picking, in its own words, the best companies it can identify in this space, driving margins higher over time. And you can see in the stock report, actually, there's been good progress on operating margins there. So what we're seeing is a company that's diversifying its revenue. It's becoming a more resilient business. It's focusing on high margins. And it's successfully moved into litigation finance as well. If you think about its three businesses, it's got legal services, which is Rosenblatt and Memory Crystal. It's got Lionfish litigation financing, which it set up about a year or so ago. And that seems to be going well. It's actually targeting litigation cases in between the £3 and £50 million range, which is different to a few of the other competitors out there. There's a shorter duration of cases, arguably better risk adjusted returns. And the interesting thing about litigation, Lionfish litigation here, is that basically none of it is factored into forecasts. So it's a nice a nice kicker. So it can generate organic growth. It can continue with its acquisitions. And then hopefully it's got some good stuff coming with Lionfish as well. It's a fragmented market. So I think it's ripe for acquisitions. And RBGP has shown over time that it can do this quite well. At the moment, it's focused on Memory Crystal and integrating that. But it's interesting because I thought the recent trading update was quite good, quite encouraging. What you would see is a lack of reaction to that trading update in terms of the share price. And even though historically the company might look expensive on a price to sales basis, for example, going forward, Memory Crystal is going to increase revenue. So it's actually looking quite cheap. It's got the forecast peg of 0.6. So it's not expensively valued when you stack it up against the growth rates it's managed to string together so far. So I think this is you're backing management here to continue executing and acquiring and growing organically into the future. And I think it looks interesting.
Thank you, Jack. Do you have any worries about lumpy revenue?
Yeah, this will not be the kind of company. It's not a Unilever. It doesn't sell lots and lots of products every day to lots and lots of people. It will be volatile, will be lumpy revenue. No 2 months will look too similar on a year-on-year comparison. So it will be lumpy. That's something you're going to have to decide if you're willing to take on board.
And sort of related to that, the question says, surely now is the worst time to buy the stock because it's gone up on the high convex activity, but this looks like peak M&A in the market.
Well, it depends how long the M&A has to run, I suppose. There's no reason why you would have to stop. At the moment, they're busy sort of digesting this Memory Crystal acquisition, but the management has a good sense of ambition about them, and I don't get the impression that they're looking to stop here. I think, again, if you look at the valuation as well, yes, the share price has risen, but the acquisition is big. And if you look on kind of forecast earnings per share and things like that, it's a relatively modest valuation.
And why do you think the share price has been tracking down since its 160 highs?
I mean, I could speculate. The honest answer is I'm not sure why it's been going down. That's the honest answer.
Thank you. And how big an issue could key person risk be? It strikes me as a bit of a people business where that is a high risk.
Yeah, it absolutely is a people business. That is what it is. It's not like a scalable tech platform or anything. To Damien's points earlier, actually, you know, there's some similarities in terms of you need the right people, you need the talent, and there's some known risks with the business model, conflict agency risks, I suppose, where, you know, how much of the profit will go to shareholders, how much of the profit will go to the talent and things like that. But RBG's acquisitions, you know, it's just going after very high margin business. So that provides some margin there.
And lots of people asking, what's your target price? This particular question, what's the target price over 2 to 3 year time horizon, given potential economic outlook?
Some of that depends on organic growth, and some of it depends on how long it takes to integrate memory, I think. And then beyond that, at some point, they might start looking at acquisitions again, which is quite a hard thing to factor in. You also have the lionfish cases, which again, these are hard things to forecast, really. So, I mean, target price, I'm buying and holding to see how the journey goes. I could imagine a share price over £2 in time, but that depends on just what management do.
Tremendous, Jack. Thanks very much. We've got loads more questions, but we've run out of time. Thank you very much. Damien, back to you.
Cool. Thanks, Jack. I mean, as you say, I've talked about Driver Group earlier. It's interesting to hear about another professional services group that's both cheap and recovering. I mean, with the course getting back to business after the pandemic and M&A booming, they should prosper, really. Anyway, next up, we have James Nelson, who's going to talk about Pebble Beach Systems. Away you go, James.
Thank you. Good evening. I'm going to present Pebble Beach Systems, ticker PEB. Let's start straight off with the Minervini question. What does the company do? In a nutshell, Pebble Beach delivers playout automation software for TV broadcasters and operators of multi-channel networks to enable them to manage their content and deliver uninterrupted broadcasts comprising both live and pre-recorded content. The benefit of this is that it reduces costs for channel owners and broadcasters and enables remote management of broadcasting and content management. Keep in mind that broadcasters are switching from legacy hardware to more flexible software-led broadcast solutions. The company has not had an easy recent history, having been acquired by Vislink back in 2014 in a desperate attempt by that company to address reversing growth. Pebble Beach, as the company was renamed, then divested the legacy Vislink divisions, but unfortunately, was saddled with a large debt burden. The company then devised a strategic plan to reshape the organization and reduce its debt from 10.3 million in early 2018. Fast forward to today, a net debt is now down to 6.6 million per the most recent interims. Profitability is significantly improved, with gross margins now close to 80%, up from the low 60s 4 years ago, and costs have been pared back. In a COVID-impacted year, 2020 saw profit before tax of 1 million on 8.4 million of sales, even after 600k of PLC costs and 400k of interest costs on debt. I bought into the company in 2019 about 6.5p, as I could see the strategy put in place in 2018 taking effect. COVID did pause things a little, although in 2021, it looks like momentum is returning to the business, and I've added further to my position earlier this year. The in-house broker FinCap noted the significantly increased order book in the 2021 interims, and did say that we leave forecasts unchanged, and in doing so, retain the possibility for future upgrades. In summary, bare points are that the company does need to deliver top-line business growth as proof of concept. This is a microcap and it can be illiquid and risky. Bull points are that Pebble Beach is an exciting tech company that's delivering on a strategy conceived 4 years ago. It's paying down historic debt. It's very profitable. It has industry-leading proprietary technology, and it's valued eye-wateringly cheap, which opens a re-rating possibility for it to be valued as a tech growth stock. Thank you.
James, thanks very much indeed. So what's their USP? Isn't this a crowded space and there are numerous dubious PLCs in this area?
It does have a number of other competitors. A number of them are larger than the company, but quite often clients want solutions from a variety of the competitors, and therefore interoperability is important. But importantly, it's not one or other supplier that gets chosen, but quite often a mix of them.
Thank you. And why is the bankruptcy risk so high?
I would assume that is because of the debt. But as I say, they have been paying that down. They've got a very supportive bank with Santander, who's come through the whole of the past few years with them, remains extremely supportive as well. But I think they've reached a tipping point already a couple of years ago where the debt burden is manageable and it's going to become a decreasing impact going forwards.
And on an earnings per share basis, the company seems quite cheap. So what's holding the share price back?
I think it's the combination of the debts. People still have that in mind. And secondly, I suspect it's a need to get that top line growth evident and there probably with a few years of track record.
Thank you. And given its size, are you worried that there are better competitors out there and Pebble won't break through against these? Is it just cheap for a reason? And beyond that, who are their competitors?
So that's the risk. They need to deliver the top line growth. But the company have been adding roles recently, including a new CFO. I think they're keen to grow potentially, obviously organically, but also potentially by acquisition. So I think they are in a very interesting space, and the next few years will be very interesting to follow.
Thank you. And in very simple terms, how do they make their money?
So it is from providing the software and technology and know-how to their clients, broadcasters around the world. Very little is actually UK-based. And they invest heavily in their R&D to keep them ahead of their competitors. And I think they have some unique tech that is very compelling on the market.
And what's your target price in what time frame?
I agree with the thin cap price target of 20p in the next couple of years or so. I think if the company was to demonstrate the sales growth that I'm looking for, and the debt continues to reduce, then I think it could be valued as a tech growth company, and that would open up a significantly higher valuation.
Tremendous, James. Thanks very much indeed. We've got loads more questions, but we've run out of time. Damien, back to you.
Hey, James, thanks for that. I do remember when Pebble Beach used to be Vizzlink, and that was taken to the brink by the directors. The only good thing they did was buy Pebble Beach. So, yeah, it's kind of nice to see a management team make a success of it, actually. I mean, my fear is they might get taken over before the shareholders benefit. But, you know.
Risk.
Worst case scenario. Cool. So next up, we have Leo Invest is going to talk about ThruVision. Over to you, Leo.
Hi. Sorry about that. I was clicking in the wrong place. Hold on. Right. So I'm new to slamming. So please let me know. Well, hold on. Let me know if I'm doing it wrong. Right, ThruVision. As you can see on Stockopedia, it's classified As a sucker stock with a stock rank of 19, revenues have been uneven with ongoing losses and cash flow is consistently negative. Cash was down by 3.2 million in the last 6 months to just 4.1 million. The chart looks terrible with no sign of cups, saucers, bowls, etc. And you could say it looks more crock than crockery. But what caught my attention about ThruVision is their near 50% gross margins, unique product and a very large addressable market. I suppose you're wondering what they've done, what they do. So what I'm going to do is demonstrate to you. So their products detect passive terahertz radiation emanating from the body, showing concealed items as dark areas. So for example, large items, can pick up larger items such as weapons and smuggled cash drugs in moving subjects, and smaller objects down to 1 centimeter squared, like a USB stick on a static charger target 3 meters. They have a range of products which trade off cost, speed and resolution with a price of 50 to 80K units. Although body parts aren't visible in the way they are in airport scanners, they have software which will automatically detect hidden items to assuage privacy concerns and to assist operators. Applications include customs borders, aviation screening and entrance transport. The area that initially most excited me was the ability to screen for weapons in places such as pubs, clubs and public transport. But it's become increasingly clear that the screening of staff in warehouses for stolen goods is the biggest short to medium term opportunity. Currently, most warehouses use manual searches and sometimes metal detectors. This is time consuming, degrading and unreliable. Sports Direct have been criticised for searching minimum wage staff in their own time. Their jobs market ever more competitive. Time is money. This loss prevention business is gaining real traction, is now expected to grow strongly for a fourth year running as they progressively sign up larger and larger companies, both retailers and third party logistics companies, culminating in the recent win of Seva, who have over 1,000 sites worldwide. In loss prevention, H1 revenue of 1 million was guided recently, and they spent 0.9 million cash building inventory in preparation to higher near term sales. High gross margins mean this will ultimately translate into 1.7 million of incremental sales, giving perhaps 3.2 million H2, of which they said over 1 million is expected in October alone. Though loss prevention is the most promising part of the business, they also have positive signs for US customs. This was the main disappointment H1, as no sales were made. I'm going to carry on until I'm cut off. While government contracts are particularly unpredictable, US customs have ordered twice before, last time for 3 million. ThruVision currently in use at 20 of the 50 Mexico border crossings to give obvious scope for expansion plus possible upgrades to older equipment. Although H1 was clearly disappointing, interim results should mark the worst of COVID-related disruption, allowing investors to focus on underlying growth and a massive runway ahead. Sorry for overrunning.
Tremendous. Well done. We have got lots of comments on this is one of the most innovative pitches we have ever seen, and top prize for demonstrating the product. It's absolutely fantastic. So you were absolutely welcome to your extra 30 seconds there. Does it screen only metallic items?
No, I mean, this is one of the big advantages. It's not just metallic items, and this is particularly useful in warehouses where you've got clothing and other relatively high value items like that, that are non-metallic. So not just metallic.
And how does its products and services and costs compare to others in this market?
Well, they're kind of unique, so you can't really compare them to any others. I had a look through supposed competitors, and the type of product they operate at, there aren't really any credible competitors. There are obviously the competition is manual searching and airport star scanners, but the airport star scanners are not passive. They need to eliminate the target with radiation, albeit harmless, and you can see body parts in them. So they don't really have any competition.
Thank you. And the company's not made any profits in the last 5 years. When will it make profit?
Well, I reckon they're going to break into profitability in the year ending March 2024. You can't go back before 2017, as I said. It was, as I didn't say, because I cut that bit out, it was a different company back then. So March 2024, I reckon. Basically the growth of 40-50% that we're seeing in this revenue protection market, a loss protection market, and the relatively fixed costs, I mean, it should come through to profitability fairly soon.
What caused the 30% share price drop in the last few weeks? The person comments they've never seen an RSI of 2. Do you think these are a concern?
Yeah, it's because I bought some, basically. I think that's the main reason. But no, seriously, it's quite illiquid, and everybody knows the market's been quite weak in the last few two months. So I think it's just and H1 was disappointing. I mean, they missed this customs order. So I think it's understandable and not anything to worry about unless you're a chartist.
How big does an item need to be before they can be spotted?
So the example they give is some USB sticks, anything down to one by one centimeter, but it depends on the situation. So to detect those, you have to have the person standing still at a distance of 3 meters. Whereas if you're trying to track moving targets in several people wide in a queue, then in that situation, it wouldn't detect a USB stick size, but it would detect weapons.
And do they have any patents for their tech, or can anyone take it, steal it from them?
Right. So they do have a couple of patents. I've looked at them. I'm never terribly impressed when I look at patents. There's one that looks completely obvious to me, and the other one, maybe it's of some value, but you know, I'm not a patent expert. But the fact is, nobody else has come up with anything similar. The closest is actually Kinetic, who came up with something a few years ago, and they're just not marketing it. So I don't. Maybe in a few years somebody could, but at the moment, no.
And what's your target price? In what time frame? And what will be the catalyst for it to achieve it?
I mean, the sky's the limit, really, in the long term, given the growth rate that you're seeing of this key market that's very large. But there are similar companies who are still loss-making, growing like this with high gross margins, which are on far higher valuations. So, you know, it could double just on a bit more exposure. But realistically, this is a show you should be holding for 3 years, I would say.
Leo, thanks very, very much indeed. We've got loads more questions, but we've completely run out of time. Damien, back to you.
Cool. Yep. Thanks, Leo. That was very entertaining. I mean, I think you're right. 3 years looks like it should benefit in a world where surveillance is a growth industry. But I guess the collapse in air travel volumes hasn't really helped them out much. I mean, I suppose one of my questions is, are they going to be an acquisition target in the US if that's where a lot of their business is? So I guess, you know, watch this space, really. Okay, next up, we have David Thornton, who's going to talk about Mission Group. Away you go, David.
Thanks, Damien. I think I'll start at the end with the valuation. This is a stock that's always looked rather cheap. I first actually wrote about it in Growth Company Investor back in 2017 at 41p. And at that point, it was trading on less than six times earnings. So it's never really been a sort of crowd favourite, although it did get up to a pound, just over a pound prior to COVID-19. And at that stage, it was on about 10-11 times earnings. So I think there was a sort of beginning to be a bit of a groundswell behind it, even though that's still a modest rating. We're now back at 70p. At which level it's on about 8 times next year's earnings and a 3.5% yield. So again, you know, still offering very good value. There was a recent pullback in the share price related to some sales by some of the old guard of management who've retired from the company. What does it do? It used to be called Mission Marketing. It's an advertising and marketing agency. It actually consists of 13 separate businesses, which are entrepreneurially run by the managers, typically who've sold their businesses to Mission and retain stock ownership in their businesses. They tend to have very good client relationships, very long-standing, good client retention, and within the UK, quite a regional bias. I mean, they do have a couple of London-based agencies, but they've got a strong sort of regional flavour to the client list, which is actually consists of quite a lot of very good blue quality blue chip clients. One thing they've been doing more recently is to increase efficiency by introducing some central services. So rather than replicating digital production facilities in half a dozen different agencies, they have a central central platform to provide that. So that should help help improve efficiency. And margins are actually recovering very nicely. They're on track to do a very respectable operating margin of 14% this year. As business comes back after COVID, you know, it's more of a late cycle recovery play. Obviously, if companies slashed their marketing budgets last year, it was one of the first and easiest things to cut, and they're now coming back. One thing which had historically perhaps weighed on the rating of the stock here was the debt. It's typically acquired agencies for debt with an earnout, and then paid it down out of cash flow afterwards. If they were going to get caught out with that, that was going to be last year when profits obviously disappeared because of COVID, and they sailed through that very nicely. Leverage ratio is now 0.7. After this year, there's no more deferred payments outstanding. So I think it's just simply too cheap, decent quality company, too cheap, late cycle recovery play.
David, thanks very much indeed. First question is, Next 15 has been growing strongly. Why has Mission not moved following the post-COVID rebound in marketing spend?
I don't follow Next 15, so I can't speak about them. But no, Mission's business has been recovering. We've got down to, I think I've got the note up somewhere here. Last year's sales were 61.5 million. They're forecast to be 71 this year, and followed by 75 next year. I mean, I actually think 75 looks to me to be a very modest target. I mean, they actually booked just over 80 million of revenue in 2019. So I think there should be scope for some good upgrades there. It is a slightly sort of later cycle business. So I think we've still got the biggest part of the recovery is actually underway now and ahead of us.
What earnings are you expecting? What earnings per share are you expecting?
I'm just basically going off the broker's forecasts. And they're looking for 6p this year and 8.6p next. Now, they did, I think I'm running saying 9.9 in 2019. Well, that might have been the forecast for an ex-COVID 2020. I can't quite remember. So I think there's still plenty of scope to see upgrades and headroom off the current platform that the business has.
Thank you. And who are the main competitors?
Any advertising agency that you care to name? I mean, it's there are a lot of them out there. It's all about building relationships, getting close to clients, understanding their needs. They do have some quite strong niches. For example, they do a lot of marketing for work with major house builders to market new build estates and so on. So they set up they'll sort of dress a show home. They'll set up marketing suites and so on, which is quite a sort of niche specialist sort of business. And that actually got hit quite badly last year, but it's one of the reasons perhaps why they're a bit slower in coming back. So that's quite an important business for them. But they're an advertising agency. I mean, you can't patent that.
And what's your view on the very generous director options?
Well, they have. I mean, you're a people business. Now there is a pretty strong level of ownership, as I mentioned in the pitch. The old management, the old chairman, and one or two of the other retiring members of the board have sold stock the other week, actually. I think that's one of the reasons why it dropped down to the current 70p level. It's a people business. You want to see people properly incentivized and have ownership. I mean, they do have a gentleman's agreement that the directors don't sell stock while they're still working for the business, which I think is a good thing.
And very quickly, what's your target price and in what time frame?
I mean, in a year's time, I mean, I would expect and hope to see the stock trading, back over a pound, So I think we can look at sort of 50% upside on a year's view. I mean, that would take it to a sort of current year PE of about 11 or 12, and hopefully prospectively back into single digits, which I don't think is demanding at all. So, that's kind of what I'd be looking for.
Tremendous. Thanks very much indeed, David. We've run out of time. Damien, back to you.
Cool. Thank you, David. I mean, it reminds me a lot of System One, which used to be known as Brain Juicer before it blew up 4 years ago. In principle, it should be easy to add value in an uncertain marketing process. But in practice, it seems a tough challenge. But still, if they can get it right, I guess the shares are likely to re-rate, as you say. So let's hope so. And finally, last up tonight, last but not least, is Darcy Andrews, who's going to be telling us all about Marshall Motors Holdings. Away you go, Darcy.
Great. Thank you, Damien. The retail motor trade has been an unloved sector for a long time. The reason? Low margins and poor return on capital employed. For investors, there has always been better companies with a better story to tell and stronger fundamentals. But now all that's changed. As background, motor dealers have four sources of profit: the sale of parts, the sale of labour in their workshops, the sale of new and used cars, and payments from the manufacturers for maintaining their required standards and hitting sales volumes. The profits in new and used cars is the area with the most potential for improvement. As has been well publicised, there is now a chronic shortage of new cars and thus used cars. This has enabled franchise motor dealers to boost their margins on car sales to a remarkable level. Results have already been supercharged in the sector and balance sheets strengthened. The best performing listed motor retailer, in my view, is Marshall Motor Holdings. Marshall's results surpass the already outstanding results for the sector, with above average operational metrics. The results of this performance are best illustrated by a TTM ROCE of 22%. The operating profit for 2020 was 30 million, and the current 12-month trailing is 79 million. Forward guidance for the year is stated at not less than 50 million. This is against a market capitalization of only 220 million. To me, that is a great indicator of the value of this company. Currently, the PE ratio is 14.4. The icing on the cake is last month's acquisition of Motorline Holdings Limited. This adds 48 franchised outlets to Marshall's existing 116, taking the total to 164. The cost of this acquisition was 64.5 million, paid in cash to include £10 million debt and £20 million of cash. A brilliant deal in my view. Absolutely superb timing. 48 dealerships captured and therefore no longer available to the competition. It is also an efficient geographical fit, expanding the footprint of dealerships with some infill as well. The benefits should be rapid, as integration of IT and processes should be straightforward. I detect a long runway in this sector. 2 years of vastly reduced car sales will create a used car shortage way beyond the end of the chip shortage. Consider also that Marshall Motor Holdings acquire a significant proportion of their used car stock as part exchanges against new cars. They also increased their stock level during the first half of 2012. Quite an achievement. My money is on them to continue their stellar performance.
Great. Thanks very much, Darcy. Why do you think they are better than Vertu or Lookers?
Right. Vertu are a very similar sized company. I think with this acquisition, Marshalls have just leapfrogged over them. And I think they are better because of this acquisition. I like the culture of Marshalls. I think they're very much a people business, and I'm not saying that Vertu aren't, but I think Marshall got the edge. But I think this acquisition is a very powerful thing. The timing of it is superb because I think they can add real value to the Motorline businesses. They will improve those businesses, and it's just a brilliant fit with what they've got already. And for that reason, I would favour them over Vertu.
And we've got lots of questions saying, isn't this all now in the price? It's at an all-time high. And where do you think the price is going to? Isn't it better to hold off for the time being?
Yeah, that's a very obvious view. And I don't agree with it for two reasons. When you look at the valuation at 220 million and the current rate of profit, if you own the whole company, it wouldn't take you many years to get your whole money back. And I think that's the way I like to value a company. And to me, there's lots and lots of headroom for it to increase. the used car shortage is incredibly serious. Marshals are very good at securing used cars. They've got buyers. They've got their own version of We Buy Any Car. But not to be underestimated, the best quality used cars come into main dealers against new cars. So they have the pick of the used cars with the best specifications, the best ownership, the best histories, the most desirable cars. And I don't think, I think there's a long runway here. I certainly don't think that that we've seen the end of the growth of the motor trade here. I think it's at the beginning.
And they've got a very high F score, so a very high risk of bankruptcy. Could you comment on that?
I don't see why. So not really. I don't get that one.
And what target price do you have for it in what time frame?
Right. Well, I think the time frame's 2 years because I think the chip shortage is going to continue for some time. There's definitely 2 year shortage of used cars. We know that because of the low volumes of new cars that have been sold over the last 2 years. That's, you know, there isn't the cars to wash through. Marshals are very good at getting hold of used cars. It's something they seem to have an edge with. So I think the time frame's 2 years, and I think my target is that they will close to double in that time.
Darcy, thanks very much indeed. We've got loads more questions, but we've run out of time. But thank you very much. Back to you, Damien.
Cool. No, thank you, Darcy. I'm impressed that Marshall Motors has a stock rank of 100, as it's rare to find a company scoring high in all of those metrics. And as you say, there's no doubt used car sellers are making an absolute pack at the moment. But I do worry it's even more a bubble than the housing market. So, yeah, interesting times. Thank you. And I'm afraid that we've come to the end of the pitches. I mean, that really was a whirlwind of information. I mean, I hope you all enjoyed the presentation this evening. I mean, I've learned a great deal about some new companies, and I hope you all have too. So please join me in thanking all of the presenters for giving up their time to entertain us and inform us. And remember, if you want to go back over any of the stock pitches, there will be a video recording available by the weekend. And on that note, I'd like to thank Tamsin and Tim from PI World for kindly hosting the event, and also Lawrence and Sam from Stockopedia for helping organise things. Now, I'm afraid there's going to be a fairly large gap until the next event. Currently, we're aiming for February the 9th next year. And there are a couple of reasons for this. One of the reasons is that we all get busy around Christmas. And for obvious reasons, we've got better things to do than talk about shares. You know, we need to open our presents and enjoy ourselves. The second reason for this is that, as I mentioned before, a key aim of the slams is to get new investors involved and willing to pitch their ideas. Now, this means that we want to encourage everyone watching the slam to feel that they can contribute. And this means you. What we don't want is for each slam just to be a feature involving a revolving list of the same investors as if this was some sort of panel show. It isn't that. It's about you. All of us are private investors here, and we all have ideas that we can share. So this is a call to action. I want you to contact me, Tamsin, or Stockopedia, and volunteer to present at the next slam in February. If nobody volunteers because they're relying on other people taking the plunge, then the next event will not take place. We want you to step forward and take the chance. Give it a go. Try and pitch an idea to other investors. It's just not that hard. And this event really is about every single one of us. It's not about some select group doing all the work. So it is important that new investors give pitching a shot. That said, I want to thank you all tonight for logging in and joining the conversation on Discord. There wouldn't be an event without you. And if you would or do want to continue the conversation on Discord or Twitter, that would be fantastic. Anyway, thank you very much, and we'll see you next year. Have a great evening.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.